Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the world. With me to discuss what you need to know about the world is Richard Haass. Richard is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has served in a variety of government roles during his career, including as special assistant to the president and senior director for Near East and South Asian Affairs on the National Security Council staff in the George H.W. Bush administration. He was also the director of policy planning for the State Department under President George W. Bush. He has written extensively on international affairs and foreign policy. His newest book, which is being released today, is The World, A Brief Introduction. Note that The World, A Brief Introduction already tops two of Amazon's Best of the Month lists for history and for nonfiction. Richard, thanks for being here and congrats on the pre-publication biz for The World, A Brief Introduction.
Thank you, Professor Lindsay. Good to be with you.
I want to note for our listeners that Richard and I are practicing social distancing in a recording from our respective homes. So we apologize for any audio issues that may crop up, as well as for any unscheduled guest appearances. Richard, I want to begin with the book, but I want to put it in the current context. Since you finished writing the book, put it into publication, we have had the coronavirus pandemic. And it leaves me wondering, what does the pandemic tell us about the world?
What the pandemic tells us about the world, Jim, is that globalization is a reality. How we respond to it is an important set of choices. But the fundamental point is that globalization is a reality. What starts in Wuhan doesn't stay there. Oceans are not moats. Borders are not impermeable. And we have to understand that in the modern world, very little stays local for long. And that, to me, is the beginning of wisdom. And then we can have policy debates about how we ought to prepare for this, how we ought to take advantage of the positive dimensions of globalization, which are often overlooked, how we protect ourselves against the negative dimensions of globalization, be it in this case viruses, could be computer viruses, could be climate change, could be terrorism, what have you. And also, and it's often overlooked, how we make ourselves more resilient in the face of the fact that on occasion, whether it's again a computer virus or a physical virus, they are going to get through whatever elaborate preparations or defenses we have. And that, to me, is the beginning of a serious public policy conversation.
So why write The World, A Brief Introduction now?
The reason I wrote it now is increasingly I came to conclude that a lot of Americans wouldn't necessarily agree with what I just said. Or even if they didn't disagree, they wouldn't necessarily be aware of it. I think a lot of Americans have been turned off the world, have been turned off on foreign policy. The results, say, of the Iraq and Afghanistan ventures. We also tend not to teach it in our schools, or if we do teach it, we don't require it. So you can now graduate from virtually any university in the United States with a four-year degree. And if you navigate your course requirements cleverly, you can essentially be globally illiterate, not know the first thing about the world that you're going to enter. And that's going to shape your life. We're also living at a time where a lot of media organizations have closed their bureaus around the world. That percentage of time devoted, say, to international news on the nightly news is virtually nil. Or even more recently, think of the Democratic presidential debates. I haven't taken out my stopwatch. Quantitative analysis is more your thing than mine, but I would bet it's not an awful lot more than 10%, maybe 15% max.
I think you're being generous.
Of these debates was devoted to international subjects, even though we're not electing the mayor of Kalamazoo. We're electing the next president of the United States. And this individual is going to have enormous discretion, enormous influence, and enormous power when it comes to doing things or not doing things in the world, all of which will have tremendous implications and consequences for 325 million Americans, not to mention the other 7.5 billion people who inhabit the planet. So I'm struck by the gap between the importance of the world and what we know about it. And what I try to do was produce a book that would help narrow that gap, not just for students, by the way, but for citizens who have to vote. Look, you're a parent, you've got kids going into the world. You know, they're lucky to have you, at least in the sense that you can give them wise advice.
Occasionally.
Well, we'll give them a chance to call in. And
I think they would call it unwanted advice, but
by definition, coming from a parent. But you're in a position to give them advice about, say, career decisions. Should I join the military? Should I join intelligence? Or business people need to understand, should I be investing here? Should I be building a factory there in my retirement plan? Should I have stocks from around the world? Should I go visit this particular country at this particular time? So all of us are making decisions as citizens or as business people or as individuals about the world. And what I wanted to do was help to arm them, to give them the foundation so they could make better decisions.
I want to go back to your point, which I think is a right one, that for a fair number of Americans don't see how the world matters to them. They see the world more as a place the United States gets involved in somebody else's problems, and it'd be best if we just sort of stayed home. It's a view typically referred to as isolationism. We can debate whether that's the right argument or not. But when you're talking to people and helping them understand that the United States has interests overseas, how do you respond to the person who said we'd be better off just sticking to our own knitting?
I do it in two ways. One is I remind them how over the last couple of decades, all sorts of things have happened in the world that have affected them. The COVID-19 pandemic is an expensive demonstration of just that. But think of 9/11, which is what, 2 decades ago now. And that was an example how a bunch of terrorists trained in Afghanistan could get on airplanes in the United States armed with box cutters, and 3,000 people lost their lives in a single day. Some people who are older might remember financial crises that originated around the world. So the analogy that comes to mind, it's not a generous one, is we can be the ostrich. We can stick our head in the sand, but the tide's still going to come in. We're still going to be affected. So that's half my argument, is that we can run, but we can't hide from the world. And if there is any silver lining from the current pandemic, it would be that people would finally internalize the idea that the world matters for better, in this case, for much worse.
That would seem to be the lesson of the 20th century, right? I mean, with World War I, the United States thought it could sit on the margins and not be affected. War came to it anyway. Then, of course, with the original America First move in the 1930s, the notion was what was happening over there wouldn't affect us. And then we had Pearl Harbor.
Absolutely.
The world tends to knock on America's door, whether the United States wants it to or not.
That's a good way to put it. And it's exactly right. But every generation seems to need to relearn that lesson. We're a continental country, so there's a lot going on here to observe us. People also tend to focus disproportionately on the costs of our international role, which are considerable. We've lost a lot of lives fighting in wars. Some of these wars, which in a previous book I dubbed wars of choice, were ill-advised. Most recently, Iraq and a lot of what we did in Afghanistan, obviously in Vietnam. So people, it'd be as if they were looking at a business plan and only saw the debit side of the ledger and didn't see the revenues. And people are ignoring the fact that over the last 70 years, there's been peace between and among the major powers, unlike the first half of the 20th century. There has been extraordinary improvements in our standard of living here in the United States and around the world. There's been extraordinary increase in the duration of our lifespans by decades. The amount of people living in democratic countries has gone up. So I look at our investment in the world and I say, pretty good returns. And by the way, that investment now, if you add up everything we're spending on defense and the like, which is considerable, but, and you know this, as a percentage of our economy, as a percentage of our gross national product, it's only roughly half of what we averaged during the Cold War. So the other argument to make is not only what goes on in the world is important and it will affect us for better and for worse, but we can afford to do reasonable things in the world and not break the bank. We can do that and still do the things we should be doing here at home. We can have, and I would argue we need to have, our cake and eat it. We need to be involved in the world and we need to make America a stronger society.
I'll point out you wrote a book called Foreign Policy Begins at Home, which talked a bit about the need to pay attention to the wellsprings of American power and prosperity. Now, we have these conversations with people. The rejoinder that often comes up is a one-word rejoinder, Iraq, or maybe a two-word rejoinder, Iraq, Afghanistan, where people recoil against American involvement that went on far longer than people anticipated and was far costlier than anticipated, and draw the inference that we should, to borrow the new buzzword, exercise restraint. Come home, America, if you want to borrow the phrase from the 1970s. How does that factor into your thinking about America's role in the world?
I think people who are critical of what we've done in Iraq and to a large extent in Afghanistan have a good point. I opposed the Iraq war, even though I was in the State Department at the time and wrote a lot about it. I have real questions about what we did in Afghanistan. So I understand that people think we've overreached and that when we overreach, it costs a lot in human life. It costs a lot in dollars and treasure. In no way are the gains commensurate with what we spent. I get it. But the answer to overreach should not be underreach. And it gets back to our previous conversation. If there's a danger in the United States doing too much in the world, there's at least an equal danger, if not a greater danger, from our doing too little. The world's not going to organize itself without us. And bad things can and do and will happen in the world if we simply leave it alone. Again, we can't insulate ourselves from the consequences. And this is true of pandemics. It's true of terrorism. It's true of the spread of nuclear weapons. It's true of climate change. We can't get others to play by the rules we'd like to see them play by when it comes to the digital space. So just because we're tired of the world doesn't mean the world is tired of us.
I want to go back to, I think, an important part of what you just said, Richard. You said the world's not going to organize itself. And this gets us into a concept that is often used by people who do foreign policy, international relations, and that's the idea of order, world order. And in your book, The World, A Brief Introduction, you talk about order. And I think for most people who don't spend their days reading the American Political Science Review or Foreign Affairs.
By the way, to interrupt, I want to make clear that I am also one of those Americans who does not spend his day reading the American Political Science Review.
I once read the American Political Science Review, so I guess I'm a reformed non-reader of the American Political Science Review. But I mean, for people who sort of don't do this for a living, sort of this notion of an order isn't necessarily transparent or clear. When you talk about an order, what is it that you sort of have in mind? What is it supposed to entail? Do we really have an order? Because a lot of people would look out and say, hey, I read a book by a guy named Richard Haass, and he told me that the world's in disarray. So how can we have an order?
Order is a really important subject. My favorite analogy is it's oxygen. We don't notice it until there's not enough of it. Order is essentially close to the word stability, and it comes about from having a balance of power. And it also comes about from people essentially saying, we ought to sign up to a certain set of rules and how we all behave. This is mainly governments. Countries are still the most important, to use a cliche, pieces on the chessboard. And they basically say, for example, we're not going to use force against one another. We're not going to use force to acquire territory. We're going to let everyone pretty much do as they wish within their borders. In return, others won't use force against us, try to acquire our territory, or interfere in what goes on inside our borders. And an order comes about when you have certain rules that people either voluntarily accept or are not strong enough to do much about. And order then is essential in order, first of all, to keep the peace. It can be very useful to promote investment, to promote trade, to promote security, and so forth. So I think the basic idea of orders is that you have arrangements that governments either voluntarily sign up to, or even if they don't much like them, they're not strong enough to overturn them. And this is the structure or the architecture of life in the world.
So what do you think is happening to that order today? You've talked about it being in disarray. Mm-hmm. I think the pandemic has brought to the forefront two things, at least. One is that the United States, or at least the Trump administration, is not interested in playing the kind of global leadership role that American administration have played dating back to the end of World War II. The second thing is that China seems to be much more assertive of its interests, not just in the region, activity in the South China Sea, but pushing very hard beyond the region to get other countries to defer to Chinese version of events. So where do you think this order we're in is going?
You focused on two important aspects of it. Again, order doesn't just happen. The United States is the strongest country in the world, but having capability is not the same thing as being willing to use it. And what's happened over the last few years, I think it began late in the Obama administration, but it's accelerated dramatically under Mr. Trump, is the American will to use its power is way, way down. So that's one reason that world order is under threat. You did mention China. You've got a rising China. So the question is, how will we think about accommodating China? If China wants something, given all its power, to what extent do we agree or push back? I'm even more worried in certain areas about Russia, because where China benefits from many aspects of the current order, because it's a large global economy, Russia does not. So if Russia does destructive things, in some ways it has less at risk. Another area where order is coming under real challenge, though, and this is what I think is unique to this period of history, Jim, is because of global challenges. Traditionally, order was largely about what we've just been talking about, the relationships between and among the major powers of the day. And the last couple hundred years of global history was largely about that jockeying. Who's up? Who's down? What are the rules? How are the rules enforced, and so forth. That's still true. So we have, on one level, all the old stuff, but what we also now have is the new stuff. We now have global issues like pandemics, like proliferation, like terrorism, you name it, where these have tremendous impact and the arrangements in place to handle them are inadequate. There's an enormous gap between these global challenges and global arrangements, and no single country, not even the United States, can handle these challenges on its own. So the reason that order is really coming under pressure now is all the old reasons, in this case, in some ways, a reluctant United States, a rising China, an angry Russia. That's the familiar stuff of history. Now you've got this overlay of these new global challenges that we don't have arrangements, we don't have rules for. And then there's one other thing, which is the context we're talking about, which is the pandemic. So you've got all this going on, the old stuff, the new stuff, and suddenly you've got countries having to come up with enormous sums of money, trillions of dollars in our case, and focus it on themselves. So we've become, if anything, more inward looking. We're spending all this revenue at a time the world needs more resources than ever to help get through and over the pandemic. And this strikes me as a really dangerous combination, the old agenda, the new agenda, and now the overlay of the pandemic, which really limits our capacity to handle these issues. And this is, as a result, to me, in some ways, the most dangerous period of modern history that we've seen.
Now, Richard, as you're describing the trends we're witnessing over the last several decades of problems, not staying home, but crossing borders, that obviously raises a big issue, conceptual issue in foreign policy and international relations. And that's the idea of sovereignty. It has really sort of been the hallmark of certainly the Western state system since the Peace of Westphalia back in the 17th century. The notion that countries were in essence in charge of events within their own borders. Now, in many ways, sovereignty was more a formality rather than a reality. How do you think about sovereignty in the world we currently exist, where problems don't stay at home? For example, we'll go back to last summer. It seems long ago, but the big story was the burning of fields in the Amazon and what that meant to one of the largest sources of carbon capture on the globe, described as the world's lungs. And the Brazilians basically told everybody else to butt out. It's our land. We can do with it as we see fit.
Let's take a step back, Jim, because it's a really big, important question. Sovereignty is one of the building blocks of order. We were just discussing it. It did come out of the 17th century. And the idea was a little bit of a live and let live society. Before then, there was constant interventions. Everybody was in everybody else's backyards. And under a sovereign world, the idea is we'll have these things called borders. Inside those borders will be countries. And other countries won't walk through the door, to use an analogy you used before, unless they're invited in. Okay, that created conditions of peace. Now, obviously, it was violated. Germany was a serial violator in the 20th century. But the idea is a powerful one. And when it's been observed, it hasn't been perfect. But when it's been observed, it's obviously contributed by definition to peace and to stability. What we're seeing in the modern world is a couple of things, though, that's threatening sovereignty. One is that global issues don't respect borders a lot. So we can talk about it all we want, but the virus didn't sign on to the Treaty of Westphalia. The virus was more than willing to go across borders. So it says to me, first of all, sovereignty, no matter how much we declare it, is not an absolute defense. It doesn't provide all sorts of protection. Second of all, what's emerged in the last few years and decades is two problems with the idea of sovereignty being absolutely respected. One we saw with 9/11. If a country allows terrorists to train and operate out of their territory, why should they enjoy the benefits of sovereignty? And indeed, the initial American use of force against the Taliban government in Afghanistan was exactly that, essentially saying, you are not meeting the obligations of sovereignty. You are allowing your territory to be used in ways that threaten us. We're not going to respect your rights of sovereignty. You've just violated them. And then the United States went into Afghanistan to remove the government, which I thought was exactly right. What we did subsequently is a different conversation. In the case of Brazil, what the world is beginning to say, and I think should say, is, hey, yeah, the bulk of the Amazon rainforest is in your territory. But the Amazon rainforest is a global phenomenon in the sense that it is an important element of our ability to manage climate change. And if you cut it down or allow it to be cut and burnt, you are doing harm to us. And we're not going to sit by and let you do harm to us. It's not just your rainforest, just because it happens to be within your borders. It has real repercussions and implications and consequences for us. So what I think is the world should do to the Brazilians and say, look, you either act as the responsible custodian of this area that affects us. If not, we're going to sanction you. You're going to pay an enormous price if you're not going to be a good international citizen. So to me, what this shows is that in reality, sovereignty is not an absolute defense against global issues. And second of all, sovereignty should not be absolute in terms of the benefits it derives. But again, I think we need to go back to the basics. It's still important. What we've seen in Europe is, say, when Russia invades Ukraine, we've seen the dangers of when sovereignty isn't respected. So this is one of those really interesting and complicated international questions where where we want sovereignty to be respected, but we also need to agree on what are the situations or conditions under which it's not an absolute. You asked before about order. Well, that's what a conversation about order is all about. That, to me, is the kind of conversation the United States needs to have with the China, with the Russia, not just in the abstract. The Secretary of State's not an academic when he's in that job, but in reality, when you talk about, okay, well, what does this mean for the South China Sea? Or what does this mean for Taiwan? Or what does this mean for Ukraine? Or what does this mean for Brazil?
Well, let me ask you just a specific question, because you really are describing some notion of sovereign obligation or sovereign responsibility. How should the United States, the rest of the international community, handle the fact that the coronavirus emerged from China? Leave aside the debate about whether it came out of the weapons lab or not, but this is a virus that seems to have a geographical spot of origin. And from what we do know, the Chinese government was not transparent early on. Indeed, we thought they were being transparent because the Shanghai Institute released the genome and everyone said this was a great sign. Then we discovered they weren't supposed to release it and were punished for doing so. And what do countries do? I know the Australians have been talking about having an international inquest to examine it, which has led the Chinese to threaten consumer boycotts of Australian wine and other products. How do you handle sort of these issues when you're dealing with a big, powerful country, Richard?
Look, it's tough because whenever you're dealing with the big, powerful countries, whether it's a China or Russia or the United States, it's one thing to reach a finding or to use a legal concept, a verdict. It's something else to impose it. So look, what China did was wrong. China did not meet its obligations under the international health regulations, under arrangements under the World Health Organization. It was not transparent. It's still not. There should be an investigation. China, I believe, should bear the onus for what it did, or in this case, is both what it did and what it didn't do. I don't think the imposition of sanctions is realistic in the sense that the Chinese would not offer them up. But I do think we should support an international investigation. I also think it's important to use this episode to strengthen the arrangements in the area of global health, that countries do have certain obligations. Now, it's one thing if you don't have the capacity to meet them, in which case a smart foreign policy would say, okay, we're going to help this country build their equivalent of the Centers for Disease Control that we have in Atlanta so they can figure out what's going on in their country, report it, deal with it, and so forth. That wasn't the problem with China. China had the capacity. So there, I think at a minimum, we ought to investigate what happened. We ought to set these standards. But you know, it bothers me that China's the beneficiary in many ways of this crisis, that it's trying to, through what's called medical diplomacy, make certain equipment and the rest available, when again, it did start there. I'd also say the one other thing, that we can blame China till the cows come home, but it doesn't mean that we're off the hook. We had plenty of notice. China cannot be blamed for our own lack of protective equipment. China cannot be blamed for the fact that 4 months later, we still don't have a serious capacity to test on a scale, anything like what we need to test on. China cannot be blamed for our inconsistent messaging, or our inconsistent application of social distancing. So part of me says, physician, heal thyself. We knew about this. This is a perfect example. We knew about this, what, 4 or 5 months ago, and we didn't respond. But yeah, China ought to be criticized, and hopefully this will lead to some introspection in China. I know there are movements in the Senate and the House, possibly in Europe, again, about sanctioning China. My own sense is we have to be careful with that, again, not because they haven't done wrong, but then we don't want to open up the can of worms that governments, including our own potentially, are open to that kind of response.
Should I want to ask you about the tension between what you've just described, diplomacy, trying to work with others, maybe nudge them into doing things, and the use of force. Obviously, for the last 2 decades, there's been a militarization of American foreign policy that has led to a backlash in the country. People are wondering, why are we still in Afghanistan after 19 years? Why are we in Iraq? Why are we in the Middle East? These things don't pay off. I mean, to what extent is American leadership about military activity or intervention versus being about diplomacy? And how do you think through questions of when to use military force?
When I think of that question, I look back on my time in government, and I've worked in the Pentagon, I've worked at the State Department, I've worked at the White House, worked on the Hill. And you've got this toolkit of diplomatic tools, and you've got military force. And even within, even saying military force, there's all different kinds of military force that can be used in different ways. You've got intelligence, which in various ways is a tool. You've got diplomacy publicly and privately. You've got negotiations. You've got consultations. You've got the whole range of security assistance. So essentially, the United States government, or any government for that matter, has a whole range of tools. We just have more of them than most because we have more capacity. Every situation, you've got to tailor your tools. What's the mix? What's the amount to the situation hand? You've also, if I can use a cliche, if you've got a square on a chessboard, you've also got to think about all the other squares on the chessboard. You may say to yourself, well, I'd like to do more here, but if I do more here, then it has consequences for what I can do there. So you've always got to look at things, not just in isolation. You got to take a step back and look at the entire scope of the world. But there's no right or wrong answer in terms of your question, other than to say, you've got to ask yourself, are the benefits, the likely consequences of using this tool, due to you say military force in this way, at this time, in this place, are the likely benefits of that greater than the costs? And how does that compare to using other tools? So it might be in a certain situation, you say, well, I want to use a little bit of force and I want to mix it with these other tools. In other cases, you might want to use a lot of force. In other cases, you may want to use no force and say, in this case, the smartest response is sanctions and diplomacy. Indeed, I think the beginning of wisdom with that is there can't be a one size fits all answer. It was funny, when I worked for President Bush the father, I was writing things for him a lot, and he gave a speech, and Bill Sapphire, who was the late great columnist in the New York Times, made fun of me in a column and said, President Bush has just delivered the it depends doctrine written by Richard Haass, and essentially says, when should we use military force? Well, Haass's answer, it depends. And,
you know, but that's the correct answer, I would think.
Yeah, it's easy to laugh at, and Bill was having fun, quite rightly. But it is the right answer that you get into trouble. You know, the other extreme is if you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think Bob Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, he would be the first to say that we tend to overuse the military instrument. And I think, coming back to the earlier part of our conversation, a lot of Americans have recoiled from foreign policy for America's international involvement, because I believe there's a perception that we have overused the military instrument and we've asked it to do things that it's not particularly well suited for. Another one of my former bosses, you know, Colin Powell, used to say, military force is good for blowing things up. You have to be really careful when you start using it for other things. And I think we've used it for too many things, in particular to try to shape the internal workings of other countries, so nation building and the like, and we've overreached both in our ambitions and in our thinking about how we could help transform other countries. And we've asked too much of military force as the means toward that end. And I believe one of the reasons we have the isolationist sentiments that we do in this country, this is what happens when you overreach, and you overreach with military force. You know, Newton's, you know, for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. Well, this is the opposite and equal reaction. And the danger is you then underreach, you go too far. And I think right now, after an era of American foreign policy, where arguably we overreached in Libya, in Iraq, and other parts of the world, we're now probably well into an era of American foreign policy where we're underreaching. This is what happens.
Richard, I want to go back specifically to the book, and I will note that Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State, said some very nice things about the book. Let me quote her here. She says, "This is the book that explains how the world really works, how it is changing, and why it matters. Just what every citizen and student needs to read." What are you hoping that people who read The World, A Brief Introduction, will take away from it?
What I'm hoping they take away from it, Jim, is that, again, what happens in the world will fundamentally affect their lives, and that they need to get smarter about it, that they need to understand the basics. Again, I'm not expecting them to make the career choice that you and I have made, but that they, in order to be an informed citizen, to know how to decide whom to vote for, or to give career advice, or to make career decisions yourself. If you're a younger person, should I join the military? Should I become a foreign service officer? If you're an investor, if you're a businessman, in all these spheres of life, in all these paths of life, what I want is people to have a stronger foundation so they can make more informed, better decisions. They can hold their elected representatives to account. So when someone says, I've got the answer to this problem, they can say, well, hold it. I don't think that's the answer to that problem. I don't understand why instituting this sanction or this tariff or using military force there makes a whole lot of sense. And I wanted to write a book that would help empower people to get more involved in decisions that would influence the course of their lives. And I couldn't find out there any single book that did it. So I wanted to write a book that was a single book, relatively short, didn't have a lot of jargon in it, didn't require that you've spent years studying it. Maybe this is the first book you've read on it. It was meant for people who are at various stages of their life. It didn't matter whether they're 60 years old or 70 years old or 20 years old. A friend of mine said, this is a good book for dads and grads.
Well, you're a big believer in lifelong learning, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just even if you did study some of these issues when you were younger, imagine you're our age. Well, we came of age, you know, during the Vietnam debate, during the Cold War. That world is gone. The Soviet Union's gone. Yep. That was a world before the internet.
I took a whole course on the Yugoslav economy. Country doesn't exist.
Exactly. Climate change is an issue. It was not talked about. So even if you did study this back when, a lot of it's obsolete. Or if you did study it back when, you'd forgotten what you'd studied. Or if you're starting out now, by definition, you haven't studied it. Or again, most people didn't study it because, again, it wasn't required. And here we are as a country. In 6 months, we're going to go to the polls. I'm hoping most Americans vote. And my goal is to help people become better informed. You know, I'm not telling people what to think or how to vote. That's for them to decide. But I wanted to give people some of the foundation that they would need to at least ask the right questions, think through the answers, and then come to their own conclusions.
Richard, I want to close by getting your advice on how people can stay abreast of international affairs. I mean, you consciously titled your book, A Brief Introduction. And at the end of it, you say there's a lot more out there, and you give some advice for how people should think about it. How do people think about trying to stay informed when we don't suffer from a lack of information? We suffer from an information epidemic. I mean, how do people make sense of who's worth listening to?
No, you're right. There's information overload. Look, there's certain newspapers that are obviously covering the world in a serious way, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Financial Times. So I would hope people would read one of those. Those are still the newspapers with bureaus around the world with well-informed reporters, correspondents. Certain magazines are really good. Our own, obviously, Foreign Affairs, but also The Economist is as excellent as a weekly. The New Yorker or The Atlantic have international stories. There's certain radio shows, certain podcasts. Look, the problem is, as you say, there's tons of stuff out there, and the internet is a material-rich environment. The problem is there's no gatekeepers. There's no authenticators. There's nobody there who edits it and says, hey, that's incorrect. You just said 2 + 2 = 5, and that's not the case. So my response is to say, go for those institutions, newspapers, magazines, television shows that are serious. So if you're interested in something about the world, there's PBS, there's National Public Radio, Fareed Zakaria's show on CNN. These are all serious places where international issues are discussed. And just also, don't depend on a single source. I'd say, as in anything else in life, don't put all your eggs in one basket. So even if you like a certain website or you like a certain columnist, what have you, just assume that that place is incomplete or may have its own agenda. So one of the things I always recommend to people is get multiple sources of information and analysis, and even go to one or two that you might feel uncomfortable with. There's worse things than exposing yourself to a set of arguments that don't feel right. Okay, that'll strengthen your game though. That'll force you to think. And you say, I somehow feel that's wrong, but I don't know why it's wrong. Okay, well then do some work on that. But there's no sort of solution to this. And all of us spend hours every day trying to stay up. But I think, for people who have lives and jobs, there's a limited amount of time. So I would say, a daily newspaper, one serious magazine, and the odd TV, radio, or website, podcast, and just have a variety. I think there's a certain safety in intellectual diversification.
With that wise advice, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new book, The World, A Brief Introduction. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Delight as always. Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe Collis pulled double duty as our recording engineer, as has been the case throughout our remote work arrangement. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.